So, Michael, thank you for continuing with the our discussions of your career for the Imperial War Museum Sound Archive. I think just before we start the further chronological narrative of your career, I think you want to go back to Lucas for a moment.
Briefly, I spoke, I think, about the almost all-absorbing interest and pressure of what was called tactical evaluation in those days. The measure of, in the Cold War as we were, the measure of a unit's proficiency was very much based on this tactical evaluation conducted by a team of mainly national but some international experts who descended on bases, put them through the ringer, firstly on a no-notice basis and then secondly for a period notified over 3 days or thereabouts. And one's career, to an extent at least, was dependent on performing well. And of course, to perform well as a station required every body to pull their weight in every way, because they tested everything. It was the nearest thing to war. And one of the things that was said to my predecessor when we went to war in the Gulf in 1991 by the frontline pilots then was, thank God for tactical evaluation, because war is very little different other than the fact you're being shot at, which is obviously noticeable, but nevertheless the pressures and the requirements were so similar. We obviously, I think, had a very good system of testing people. And so the trick was to try to find a different way of doing it, or at least to enhance one's posture, as it was called, to take on the various challenges that the tactical evaluation team would put on you, and as they were experts, they'd seen it all before, and to come up with something that floored them was a challenge. And probably the biggest single demand on a station was, in fact, the ground defense aspect. Stations are huge, huge areas, so whilst one can get airplanes airborne, because one's pretty expert in that, whilst one can do the various things that go to support that flying effort, defending a huge tract of land with relatively few people whose primary job anyway is to get airplanes airborne, was a major challenge. So 24 hours guarding with people who would find it quite easy to get onto to bases and then cause mayhem. So we did two things to improve, as it were, our approach to this. The first one was we co-opted the local police, and whilst there was always on stations a commitment from the police in principle to help in a wartime situation, in practice nothing much ever happened, in my experience. Whereas at Lucas, whether because we had a particularly right-wing chief constable or whether they've genuinely found an interest in this, not only did they say yes we will, but when it came to the actual event, they were there in force. And the first thing that the tactical evaluation team knew, that they were arrested as they got off the railway station. And then as they were sort of wrecking the joint, they were arrested again, and they started to hold out yellow and red cards saying, you can't do this to us. And we said, well, we've just done it. This is war. And they said, but you can't. You can't guarantee that you will get this level of commitment from the police in war. And I said, yes, we can. I have a document to prove it. And that really floored them. So anyway, we got this fantastic support from the local police, which I think was a model of its kind, probably quite realistic, but we were able to take it much further than anybody else had done. And it caused wry amusement, I think, down in the corridors of power, that we'd actually put one over on the Tankerville team, some of whom took it in good part, but those whose job it was to penetrate our defences didn't think it was a good idea at all. The other thing we did was to co-opt a number of volunteers for what we call the Wives...
It was a disaster team.
Yes, a disaster team, but it was first aid, basically. We were required to have first aid teams trained on the station. But actually, by far the most qualified people on the station were usually wives, because some of them had been nurses, or some of them maybe even been doctors. And we set up a training system which trained, and I think we had something like three teams of really extremely well-trained wives whose job it was to administer first aid And again, this rather threw the tactical evaluation team, because they said, you can't do that. And say, well, we've just done it. We've trained them. There's the evidence. They've signed, you know, you can't guarantee they'll be here in war. And I said, well, why not? Why not? So anyway, that was good. And they were duly marked and approved of by the tactical team, weren't they? I think they were quite impressed that we'd gone to that amount of troll. In fact, they probably got more training than the average airman did. So that was that.
Now, the tactical evaluation team, they come up from London, they come up
yes,
from...
Yes, they were based usually at High Wycombe, and they co-opted people from air forces around in Europe as well.
To come up and evaluate you in a wartime situation.
That's right.
And they were meant to penetrate your defences.
Amongst other things.
But you don't penetrate an air force's squadron's airfield's defences by getting off the train at Lucas. You come in by the sea, don't you?
Well, indeed. Yes, they did. They actually parachuted people in on occasion. I mean, we got the full works. The SAS and the special boats and the whole lot came in and created mayhem on occasion. But that was, to an extent, predictable, and you could defend a little bit against that, even if you didn't have the firepower to deal with special boats. At least you could identify, say, well, you know, we would expect to have the army in war coming to help us on this occasion. We're not the army. The important thing was to stop the individual or couple of guys who would be coming in what was called the Spetsnaz, the Russian special forces, who would operate in ones and twos, who would be put ashore somewhere and then come, get onto the airfield and stick explosives around the place, blow it up, do all sorts of things there. That was a challenge because they could slip in, you know, on this huge area. So you had to have a very effective system of monitoring. But the one thing that we had on our side was in that part of the world, and probably on most stations, they're remote. So if you've got the local population aware, particularly the police, that any stranger seen in that area there is likely to be up to no good, which is really how the police operated. They knew everybody who lived in Lucas. Somebody gets off the station and starts to walk towards the airfield who looks a little bit different and come and feel his collar, as they say.
And did
guns in their boot.
Yeah. And did you have RAF regiment? They would be there, would they not?
But they had a specific job. The RAF regiment, we had a unit whose job was to man the rapiers, and they would look after their own very well. But we only had a very few people who were there specifically to guard. I mean, the RAF was not established to guard its airfields. You had to rely on using, misemploying existing manpower. There simply wasn't enough to go around. In theory, you were reinforced from training units, and we did get some, but to defend an airfield of hundreds of acres, you need, you know, a couple of thousand people probably to do it on a 24-hour basis, and there's no way that we ever got that sort of reinforcement.
And just as a purely practical matter, when you have the special forces who are masquerading as the Russian special forces arriving in SAS and whoever, how do you determine that you've dealt with them? Because these chaps are fairly irregular, and they will say, well, you haven't actually dealt with me, and they'll carry on.
The tactical evaluation team would be there. They were around all the time, you know, identified with yellow sort of things on them, and they would be lurking to appear, because they knew that the special boats were going to come ashore at, you know, on one of the beaches at 2 o'clock in the morning, and they would pitch up and then adjudicate what happened there. And one of them would be there, or two of them would be there, another one would be at the reporting post to see how it was reported in, to see how the reinforcements would be sent, and that sort of thing. So each incident was planned and controlled to the degree you would never control special forces. I mean, they mainly got out of control. It got quite rough. I mean, when the special boats came ashore, yeah, quite rough. But anyway, they enjoyed it.
And that's not the sea that was rough. That's the reception they received.
The reception they gave our lot, because I mean, these chaps take no prisoners. They came in with the thunder flashes and God knows what. And quite a terrifying lot, actually.
Kill the sheep.
Kill the sheep, yes. Yeah.
Well, thank you for that digression. We'll go back, if you're happy, where we left it last time, which is you were in the middle of support command and you had three AOCs.
Yes.
And we left it close to a question I asked you about whether you were happy to do that job as an air marshal at the age of 50, not having done any of the other three immediately subordinate jobs to you, and you gave your answer for that.
Yes, yes.
And that's really where we were. I don't know whether you wish to...
Well, let me start then by reminding you, and I probably said this before, but the three AOCs, one was concerned with all training in the Royal Air Force, one was concerned with all the maintenance and logistics side of it, both mechanical and electrical engineering of the Royal Air Force. And the other one was what's called directly administered units, which was all the little bits and pieces all over the place, tiny little places, both at home and abroad, which didn't have a clear allegiance to one of the existing commands, such as RAF Germany or Strike Command. Fell into that area that they need to be administered, which is what we had. So, and we had some 37,000 people, not all in uniform, but civilians and et cetera, working in the command at the time. So it was quite a substantial command. And I remember there were 200 and something units. I never got round them all in the time I was there. It was just too many to get round. Yes, hospitals were in there as part of the DAUs. I think they were directly administered units. All the hospitals were there. It's quite long.
So you had 37,000 people
about
in
that.
One form or another under your command?
Yes.
That's the largest in the Air Force, isn't it?
No, I think Strike Command probably was a little bit larger. See, Germany was really always very small. We probably only had 10 or 11,000 people in Germany. So that would have taken... And they would have been almost entirely blue suits. So for my 37,000, I would think probably 32,000 were in uniform and 5,000 or thereabouts were. Strike Command had more, because the Air Force at that stage was about 90,000 people. So...
Yes.
You see, we administered all the people working in the Ministry of Defence, all the people working in the procurement executive, as it was at the time. We administered them. We looked after their well-being, because they worked in strange, amorphous places which didn't have that sort of thing. So, in the sense that we were responsible for their disciplinary processes, we commanded them. But, you know, I couldn't turn around to somebody in the Ministry of Defence and tell him to do this, that, and the other. It was only in the administrative field that I had that sort of responsibility. So one shouldn't get too excited about those numbers in relation to perhaps the Strike Command, which had rather more at the time. But it was infinitely bigger than RAF Germany, which was really quite a small command in comparison.
Right, I understand. I'm going to... I must ask this question. Earlier in our previous discussion, you said that you had clearly been, you thought, picked out for higher things at a certain stage in your career. And I'm just looking at now the order, you know, the order of events as they now take place. As you go to Strike Command, then Whitehall as Chief of the Air Staff. How many other people do you think there are in the Air Force who would all be jostling? In other words, how many men are there jostling for only so many places once you get to this sort of level, Air Marshal and above?
Well, it would have been quite difficult to analyse that until I got to support command. I think all I could say to sort of reinforce that was that by being promoted to Air Vice Marshal very quickly from Air Commodore and being given this plum job at NATO, I was clearly being given an opportunity. Now, if I'd blown it there, then I would never have got that third star. But if you looked at the track record of the people who'd gone there, half of them had been previous chiefs of air staff. So it was obviously a very groomy position, but one had to perform. Once one had performed and had then been given a CNC job, if one was very ambitious, one could look around and say, well, who's the opposition? Who's going to, you know, who's doing better than me at age 50 as a three-star? And really, I guess, at that stage, there were only two of us in it, because Caddy Hine, who was at Strike Command, was going to retire because Peter Harding was staying on to hopefully become Chief of Defence Staff, and Paddy was of an age that he couldn't have stayed on and been Chief of Air Staff as well, although quite obviously he would in the normal course of events have been, I think, very well received as chief of air staff. So he was due to stay on for a bit, and then Roger Palin was given Royal Air Force Germany, the third command. And so it was clearly Palin and myself, I guess, who were being run for future higher things. Although, to be honest, at that time, it wasn't really on my radar screen particularly. You know, you did every job as it came and then saw how you got on.
I don't mean to suggest in any way that, that what you said is anything other than the case, but it wasn't on your radar screen. I just wonder how many directors of BP who are full-time directors do not have half an eye on the chairmanship.
Yeah, I think, to be honest, I rather felt at the time that my qualifications, particularly my NATO qualifications, which I had got probably better than most other people at that. The job that I'd had at NATO plus my previous NATO experiences qualified me very well in NATO, and therefore I might well do a job, commander-in-chief job, and then move back into a NATO arena where there were some, you know, top jobs. And I guess if I thought much about it, then I thought probably Roger Bailey would become CAS. But there was a lot of water going under the bridge before then, as far as I could see. So it really wasn't. I wasn't focused on it on the radar screen at all. Not until I got probably to Strike Command.
Right. Well, would this be a timely moment to move to Strike Command, or do you have anything further you'd like to say about Support Command?
To say about, and I can't remember whether I said anything earlier. Probably not. That. At Support Command, we did some quite thoughtful things in terms of starting to make the adjustments to the Air Force that were beginning to come onto the horizon in the light of the changing international situation. You see, while I was there, the Berlin Wall came down, and we started to look for the peace dividend that would emerge from that. And if you recall, we then went to the Gulf War. Quite a lot of people from Support Command supported the Gulf War. Paddy Hine rang me up one day and said, I need 500 men immediately from your support to help me because my chaps are gone and I've got all this to do. So we provided them. And I think what it showed to me then was the importance of having those support capabilities in, as we would call, Support Command, but whatever you like to call it, in order to reinforce the front line when you get a crisis situation like this. If we hadn't, I don't know what he would have done. It would have come to a full stop because all these men had gone to the Gulf. And they still had, airplanes to put together and get out to the Gulf and so on and so on. And we were able to help that because we had a third line, a big third line capability at a place called St. Athan, which is where the major third line work was done for the Royal Air Force on all the front line airplanes. So the tie-up between us was a strong one there. We were introducing a thing called the new management strategy towards the end of my time there, which was, I thought, rather inspired. And the idea of the new management strategy was to have budgets, because previously all money was essentially held in the Ministry of Defence and passed downwards notionally.
Thank you.
To commands who had no real control over it because they didn't have the information. All the information was held in the Ministry of Defence, and I think I made this point to you earlier. It was usually sort of a feast or famine because the measurement of where you were in the financial year was so chaotic that usually on the 1st of February said, Christ, we've overspent, now we've got to stop doing everything, or we've got to spend all this money by the 1st of March, or the 31st of March, rather, and get on with it. Chaotic arrangement. So wouldn't you manage it much better, went the argument, by delegating those budgets down, bid for them, control them, and, very importantly, if you make savings over and above those you're asked to make anyway, then you get some return on that. You can use that money that you save for the betterment of your people or equipment or whatever it happens to be. A thing called incentive, which common sense would tell you is a rather useful thing for people to have. So this started to come in, and we were the lead command on this, and we were introducing it and had been into the maintenance side of it. And very successfully, because I think, you know, our engineers and logisticians were very adept at this sort of thing. They got the sort of mind that could look at things and price them and work out how better to do it. And we were making really very, very substantial savings in the way that we were doing business. And Snatham was a lead in this, and Locking, too, was another station, was demonstrating the way that things could be done once you had the financial information on which to base your decisions. If you knew, for example, that, you know, industry was charging you incredible sums of money for replacing or doing things to the canopies, and you said, well, hang on, I think we could do this ourselves, and we did. And we employed a couple of people to sort of do things, a bit like your car windscreen. You know, you don't have to replace your car windscreen every time. You can actually put a little bit of stuff in there and smooth it all out, and it's done. And it costs tuppence as opposed to £200. And we started to get into that once you knew what the information was. So that was actually very good. But I think that the major challenge that we had was drawing down at a time when the defence budget was being, you know, racked savagely down. I mean, basically, all the services in 1990-1991 were reduced by roughly one-third in the front line, with commensurate, if not greater, savings in the support arena. If you translate that into reductions in manpower, if you translate that into reductions in bases, I mean, we had huge numbers of people moving, you know, reductions in Germany, reductions in bases, and we, by our own right, amalgamated and put on one or maybe two bases stations that had previously taken three, four, or five units to run. And that was quite traumatic for a lot of people to do that.
Can I ask a question about this peace dividend? Because you have surprised, I mean, I knew that it was going quickly. You have surprised me, even me, if you like, by the speed at which, was this entirely a political, I think Tom King was Defence Secretary at the time, and was this entirely a political directive, or did the Chiefs of Staff say, well, we better get our shot in first, and say, well, we can reduce by sort of 22% and agree to go to a third, whereas the politicians probably want to start a third and go to half. Mm. How was that peace dividend? That's a massive cut, isn't it, of a third?
They set up, I can't remember what the name of the study was, which was a tri-service study into what would be an appropriate front line, if you like, in the post-Cold War era, at which stage we went to war, which was ironic, because during those processes of deliberation, they concluded that we could do it with X number of regiments, X number of squadrons, and X number of ships. And all of that came out, and some of those ships and some of those squadrons and some of those regiments were actually fighting a war in the Gulf, which was quite difficult. Say, well, you know, thank you very much, now we're going to disband you, having just done a fantastic job. We were required always to be looking for savings because the budget was never, you know, never has been. And there was an imposition of 3% savings year on year placed on us anyway. So you were having to look for ways to do things better. And the process by which that was done was the one I've sort of described, is to look to reduce the number of units and centralise things so you can cut down on the peripheral management costs of that. Because the problem with all of that is then it reduces career opportunities as well, whereas you had five station commanders, five wing commanders, five whatevers, you've now only got one. You know, how do you groom your future people? And this is a problem that's true across all the services. But the actual final sort of cut was made by Tom King based on what he thought he could get away with, I think. And, you know, the chiefs at the time would argue vehemently for their positions. And I think we all felt we'd been slightly hard done by, which probably meant that there was equal misery all around. Although a lot of people thought the Air Force got away with it better than the other two services, which I'll come back to later.
And this, of course, was Treasury-driven, really.
Yeah.
Tom King would have been happy to say, well, we'll stay roughly where we are, no doubt. Privately, possibly?
Yes, I mean, it was definitely driven by Treasury. It was, you know, start of a difficult period in the country's financial...
Yet again.
Yeah, yet again, that's right.
Yes. Mm. Okay, thank you. If that is all that you wish to say about support command, and I've noted that you want to come back to something, You then moved to Strike Command?
Yes, I did 2 years there, and when Paddy Hine left, Peter Harding was selected to be Chief of Defence Staff, and I was told in the October, before he went, that that was happening, that I would take... No, I'm sorry, I got it all wrong. No. That's right, he was there. I was told that I would take over from Paddy Hine at Strike Command after my 2 years, and the then Assistant Chief was a chap called John Thompson, a good friend of mine, was going to take over from me. And Roger Palin, who was then in Germany, was going to come back and be what's called Air Member for Personnel to be on the airport. So he was still very much in the frame. And that's what happened. And we moved to High Wycombe in April 91. Yes. Wasn't it? Yes. Oh, no, it's about April 91. Maybe.
Okay.
Probably before, but not a lot. Nothing about that. Yep.
And you're inheriting, among other things, of course, a rapidly contracting, gently contracting air force as a result of what has just transpired?
I was inheriting two things. I was inheriting the back end of the Gulf War. It was over, but it was still bubbling. I inherited the Kurdish problem, which was still going, and we were the lead in the UK for that one. So Operation Provide Comfort, I think it was called, to look after the...
This is out of northern
Iraq, the Kurds fleeing, and then
Turkey,
being looked after.
Yes, out of Turkey.
Turkey and, yes. And fleeing from... you know, everything in Iraq, just trying to get away. And we set up the no-fly zone and all of that to give them protection. We had a few people on the ground. I went out there very early on to see what was being done, right up towards Diyarbakir and a place like that, a huge camp, and where all the chaps were who'd been out, you know, military, air force, all of them, totally international, whose job it was to go in and help really provide first aid and comfort to these poor wretched Kurds. But I went out a couple of times when I was there. The operation gradually wound down and we were able to leave people in northern Iraq, in the Kurdish area, monitoring things for a while. But then the Kurds, as always, fell out amongst themselves, and so it got extremely dangerous. So from providing some people on the ground, which is obviously the best comfort you can ever give, we then had to police it from the air. And in effect, we did that for the next 10 years until we had another Gulf War.
How do you police something from the air?
Regularly and noisily.
Just by a great deal of physical presence?
Absolutely. Yeah, absolutely. And making it unpredictably. And making it very clear that if anybody from the other side enters that no-fly zone, and we meant also on the ground, if people had come, which they didn't, then they would be zapped.
So if Iraqi main forces went into, on the ground, the no-fly zone...
Well, we would have done two things. Firstly, we would have seen the build-up, so we would have said, don't do it. And secondly, we would have reinforced very quickly with our air and beaten them up seriously. On the way up there, whilst reinforcing by land, we would have to have reinforced by land as well.
And this continuing hostilities, they were sanctioned under the UN, or
yes.
Was it? They were,
yes,
were they?
It was a UN operation.
Right.
Yeah.
But entirely operated at the northern end by Britain, or not?
No. The Americans and the French and ourselves were there. We operated from a Turkish base called Incirlik.
And the French were there. That
French were there, yes. French were there for a few years. A few years. And then they gradually withdrew.
Were they worthwhile?
Yes. They provided a useful capability. I mean, they had taken part in the Gulf War, or perhaps a little reluctantly initially, but it suddenly realised they better be in, so they were, and had not performed at all badly. And they were really quite capable. So they provided some very useful reconnaissance capability, which was certainly... an essential part. I mean, the critical thing about that operation was not just the presence of the Kurds. The Kurds themselves were comforted, and they were. And I remember sitting in a Kurdish tribal leader's hut in northern Iraq, talking through an interpreter to him about this. You know, did it really help these aeroplanes? And he said, absolutely, you know, it's wonderful. We know that somebody's there. We know that these aeroplanes can do things to the Iraqis if they come. But actually, from our point of view, almost as important was the intelligence information we were able to gather. All the airplanes over there had reconnaissance capabilities and things like that. So we were monitoring, you know, visually and electronically what was going on with Iraqis. So we had very, very good information.
Supported, I assume, by, American satellite...
All sorts of things, yeah. Yes. Yeah, that's right. Mm.
And were there special forces on the ground at the same time?
There were initially. But after the problems there, we withdrew all our forces. At least we said we did. I suspect there might have been one or two knocking about.
One or two left.
But anyways, the Kurds are the worst enemies. I mean, as you probably know, there's a nasty little group of them who are nothing more than really drug smugglers and crooks.
Yes.
And which makes it very difficult for the ordinary Kurd trying to subsist an existence in...